Hello and welcome to this, the latest in an ongoing series of podcasts from Polity. My name is George Miller, and I'm pleased to say my guest on this programme is Eli Zaretsky, who's Professor of History at the New School for Social Research in New York. Eli Zaretsky's interests are in 20th century cultural history, the theory and history of capitalism, and the history of the family. He's the author of Secrets of the Soul, a social and cultural history of psychoanalysis, and of Capitalism, the Family, and Personal Life, both of which have been widely translated. I met Eli Zaretsky in London recently to talk to him about his new book, Why America Needs a Left. From the beginning of the Republic, he writes on the book's first page, most of America's thinkers and political leaders have argued that the country neither had nor needs a significant left. His book maintains that this is a false and misleading way to understand America, and that the country has seen the left play an indispensable role during periods of crisis in its history, providing what he calls successive refoundings of the country's values, recalibrations, if you will, of the country's moral and political compass. The first of these crises was a slavery crisis during the Civil War. The second, the crisis caused by the rise of large-scale corporate capitalism that culminated in the New Deal. And the third, a present crisis of affluence and global power that began in the 1960s. For each crisis, Zaretsky argues, there was a left, and together these lefts constitute a tradition, albeit a discontinuous one. When we met in central London a few weeks ago, I began by putting to him the orthodox view. His country has had no significant left, nor does it need one.
I argue in the book that we've always had a left, but where you really see the importance of the left in American history is in periods of crisis. And by crisis, I don't just mean an economic crisis or a war, but I mean a turning point in the nation's history, a time when the nation has to really decide who it is, what its values are, what direction it's going to move in. And I contend that there were really three such crises in American history: the crisis over slavery, the crisis of the Great Depression, and basically the crisis we're in today. And in my view, started in the 1960s. And in each crisis, I say a left has played an indispensable role. In the case of the slavery crisis, there was the abolitionists, so the first American left. They really invented the whole idea of a left in America. In the second crisis, it was the socialists and the Popular Front and the Marxists and so forth. And today, it's the new left.
Mentioning abolitionists brings up the idea that race has been a key issue. Unlike the lefts in say parts of Europe, race has been an issue that has gone hand in hand with the left through its development in the United States.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, race really defines American history. It starts as a slave society, and the abolition of slavery. What I really argue in the book is that there are really two histories of America. There's one history that begins with independence, and that's a liberal history. And then there's the history that really begins with the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, and that's a history that's based on equality. In my lecture tonight, I'm going to suggest that this importance of slavery and race in the formation and the origins of a left is not unique to the United States, because I think everywhere slavery was really the big question that gave rise to the idea of a left in the 18th century. Later, Marx, when Marx wrote about it, said it's the rise of capitalism or the rise of industry. But when you really look at it, even in the French Revolution, slavery was a central question.
You contend that at these moments of crisis, the outcome was not exclusively determined by the left,
right,
but it was inflected by the participation of the left. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, my view is that the left plays an indispensable role, but it doesn't mean that it plays a dominant role. It's not that the left brings the solution to the crisis. It brings something that you must have to resolve a crisis. And what you need a lot of things. You need leadership. You need the kind of consensus on liberal values and so forth that I think we do have in the United States. But the left brings this passionate commitment to equality, this very, very deep belief in equality. And to resolve a crisis for a nation that is that large and that diverse to come together and to form a new agreement on values, it needs this belief in equality. And that's really the precious thing that the left has contributed. In the abolitionist case, it was it was racial equality. In the socialist case, it was social equality, and that for the new left, it's equal participation. And this is a vital part of something that is much larger, but you can't resolve what is much larger unless you also have this.
And we see discontinuities in the ways in which those on the left have considered themselves, have named themselves. But do we see continuities in the way that they have engaged in political activism throughout the last couple of centuries?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that distinguishes my approach to understanding the American left is seeing the discontinuity. That is, really, the United States is a nation that's 250 years old, approximately, but you only have a strong left in maybe 30 or 40 of those years. So in one sense, the left is a kind of episodic upsurge. It comes only in like crucial moments, like the 1830s and 40s and the 1930s and the 1960s. But on the other hand, these lefts, and this is what I'm arguing in the book, do constitute a tradition. And what they do is elaborate the idea of equality and the idea also of what Abraham Lincoln called something is placed there for future use. Namely, we do things at crucial moments of our history, and we don't really know why, but they give the nation a direction. They become markers. Lincoln said that about the proclamation of all men are created equal in the Declaration of Independence. They believed in slavery when they wrote that, but it was there for future use to be reinterpreted. And so I'm arguing that the left in America has laid down certain markers of racial equality, social equality, participation in civil society and equal roles and so forth that are there for future use.
I was struck, Eli, reading the book, that there is a definite running theme of the role of violence in U.S. history and politics. And you do indeed say at one point, a proclivity to violence runs very deep in American liberal tradition. I wondered if you could say a little bit about what role you think it has played.
Yeah, I mean, when you can't study American history without seeing how this proclivity to violence breaks through regularly, very often it's been associated with the rise of the right. I mean, the Civil War was itself incredibly violent, and reversing the idea of racial equality, reversing Reconstruction and so forth, it happened through violence. It happened through the Ku Klux Klan. And again, Roosevelt, in the time of the Great Depression, when he took office, he really compared himself to a military leader and said, we were in a war. Eleanor Roosevelt wrote that it was the most frightening part of his first inaugural address in 1932, was the kind of cheers he got when he said, we're going to go to war against the Depression. And then again, you see in the 1960s, where you have a great convergence of radical ideas and mainstream liberal ideas at the time of the Civil Rights Movement and the Medicare and so forth, and it all comes crumbling down because of the war in Vietnam. So this is a fundamental theme in American history, is this question of violence, and it's something that if we get a new radicalism, it's something that we're really going to have to think a lot about.
The effects of your first two crises, or the outcomes of your first two crises, did have redistributive effects. Whereas when we get to the new left in the 1960s, the outcomes had rights implications, legal implications, but didn't have redistributive effects. Do you think something profound had changed in the American nation by that stage, which meant that those outcomes weren't possible any longer?
See, actually, the abolitionists were not redistributive. They were criticized. Each left criticized the previous left and tried to improve on the previous lefts. So the second left, the socialists and Marxists and so forth, criticized the abolitionists because they weren't redistributive. They felt that the freed slaves, ex-slaves, needed to be given land, needed to be given education and so forth. And that wasn't done. The abolitionists really believed that if we just abolished slavery, everything would work out. And it's true also that the new left was not redistributive either in the way that the left of the 30s and 40s, the left of the Popular Front, had been centrally redistributive. But for one thing, the new left assumed that redistribution was a established part of the American politics, and they tried to go beyond it. So they were really not trying to get rid of redistribution. They were trying to avoid the tendencies toward bureaucracy and toward statism that had been built into the welfare state, and to raise new questions of equality in the family and in personal life, not to get rid of redistribution. So redistribution is really one moment in the history of the left. But to go to your more basic way in which you frame the question, something, yes, has definitely changed. And I mean, I think we have a left now that is much more concerned with freedom and really exploring new meanings of freedom and so forth since the 60s. So that redistribution is not at the center of contemporary left, in my view.
It's questions of identities rather than redistribution.
Well, I wouldn't exactly put it that way. Questions of identity have certainly been central since the 1960s. But the way I put it in the book is that you can't really deal with these questions of identity in the sense of feminism and in the sense of the civil rights movement and gay liberation without having a background conception of equality. So I make a distinction in the book between meritocracy and equality. We've achieved in the United States, or tend to achieve, meritocracy. We have a black president. We believe that, you know, women should, we're going to have a woman president and these kinds of things. But actually, when you go back to the 1960s, when these questions that we call identity first emerged, they actually emerged as broad questions of equality, social equality. The civil rights movement in the 1960s was totally about poverty. It created the war on poverty. And it was not just about black poverty, it was about poverty in general. And similarly, when the gay movement, for example, when it started, it was part of the anti-war movement. It had the slogan, "You can't touch my body. My body is like Vietnam. You're invading my body," and slogans of that sort. So I do think that we have to get back to seeing the connectedness of issues that we call identity today with broader issues of social equality, absolutely.
And you describe the new left, somewhat paradoxically, as the shortest lived but the most enduring of the three lefts you consider. Can you say in what way?
Well, it was short in the sense that it was so intense. It was such an upsurge. I mean, I basically would date the birth of the new left to the sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I count as part of the new left the radical students in SNCC, the radical students in the civil rights movement. And what they did, which is sort of central to the left, is break the codes by which democratic society is supposedly organizes and allows protests to take place, but actually channels it and weakens its force. And the end of the new left is really by the early 70s, or not really, actually more like the mid 70s or the late 70s. I mean, the nation really vacillates between right and left in the 70s. So that's actually a very short time. But it's also enduring in the sense that it really sort of lays down a new paradigm, a post-socialist paradigm, which is not to say that socialism or the critique of capitalism is not a very central part of the left today, but the new left creates a new paradigm, new understanding of freedom. We see it throughout the whole world. So in that sense, it's also the most enduring.
Ought we to be surprised, given the current crisis, that there isn't more of an upsurge from the left? Because we've had the Occupy movement, but given the depth of the crisis, is that in itself a surprise?
Well, the Occupy movement was extremely heartening because one could see it was almost like the American people were waiting for someone to speak these kinds of obvious truths, even though the Occupy movement doesn't have an analysis of American society or program or any of the things that you would identify with the left. It's not a surprise that we have not had more of an upsurge. I mean, basically, the last 30 or 40 years have been a period in which the whole idea of a left, because it was so powerful in the 60s, has been suppressed, it's been marginalized, it's been made fun of, claimed to be irrelevant, and so forth, going back to the 70s. So people, try to avoid the idea. And also in other periods of crisis, I mean, Tocqueville was shocked by the equanimity with which Americans accepted slavery. After the Great Depression of 1929, nothing really happened for a couple of years. It was the election of Roosevelt in 1932 that mobilized people. I think leadership is very important. I do think that had Obama, when he was elected in 2008, actually tried to lead the country in a genuinely new direction, obviously not a left direction, but a new direction, which obviously would have meant a break with just pure markets and a break with war as the centerpiece of American foreign policy, had he tried to do something like that, I think there'd be an enormous upsurge in the country. In fact, I think Occupy Wall Street was a response to that vacuum. So I don't know. These things are unpredictable, when there'll be a left upsurge and when there'll be a right upsurge. But no, I'm not surprised that we've had not so much of a response to the current crisis as one might have thought.
Is there also a part being played by the success with which neoliberalism has claimed what once was viewed as countercultural and repurposed it to its own ends and basically commodified it?
Yeah, I mean, I would go even a little further than that and say that emancipatory elements of the 60s fed into neoliberalism. It isn't only that the neoliberals absorbed the ideas of the 60s and started selling underwear under the name Revolution and things like that. But actually, neoliberalism has had really genuinely emancipatory aspects. One of the things I was really struck with when Steve Jobs died recently was how much of Silicon Valley and the electronics revolution and so forth was rooted in the new left and in the counterculture and the drug culture and so forth. And just the idea of individual emancipation was so central to the 60s. And there is a resonance between that and the market. Furthermore, neoliberalism has a very strong argument when it claims that markets are necessary for certain things, and that especially that capitalism can deliver a certain kind of economic efficiency. These are really actually old arguments that in many ways were worked through in the 1930s with Keynes. You don't need a socialist government, but what Keynes argued was that you need macroeconomic policies, you need government policies that markets by themselves won't work. So the whole question of neoliberalism is a complicated question. It's by no means just a simple disaster that absorbed new left ideas and came to power falsely. But on the other hand, it certainly is not, as the neoliberals present it, as a simple positive thing that is just going to continue to produce growth. It's not. It's going to destroy the world if we don't have more regulation, more government, more democracy mixed in with markets.
And you say, Eli, at one point in the book, the right is a reaction to the left, and that might surprise some readers and some listeners, given your description of the left as often quiescent in American history and only being resurgent in periods of crisis.
I mean, if you go back to the French Revolution, the father of modern conservatism, Edmund Burke, it's a response to the French Revolution. And in American history, we don't really have an historic right the way you have in Europe, but we have sort of a right-wing populism. And that has been a reaction to the periods where the left has been strong. There's the Ku Klux Klan period and other forms of the right that follow the Civil War. And then McCarthyism is a response to the New Deal. And then the 1970s is a response, the neoliberals and especially neoconservatism, it is a response to the new left. And as you say, it absorbs a lot of the ideas. So, I mean, the basic argument I make in the book is that it's the interaction between a radical left and a kind of liberal mainstream that is really drives the history forward, that has a sense of the nation as having a telos, a purpose, and because they share this idea of equality. And the right is really a reaction to those periods when you have a surge forward.
How sanguine are you about the intellectual life of the left currently? Because reading the book, it's clear that at various points there have been figures of intellectual weight who've come forward and written books which have been influential beyond the university. How healthy do you think that is at the moment?
Well, that's that's a good question. In the United States, many people have asked me how I could have any faith at all in any kind of rational discourse or rational future in the United States, given the amount of, noise, given the contending voices, the low level of so much and the irrationality of so much. And I don't have a good answer to that, except that one has to keep trying. The New Left was incredibly productive intellectually. Many great thinkers were produced, and many great figures were produced. When I think about when people ask me how can you possibly ever think that there would ever be a left again, given the way the country is today, I think about someone like Noam Chomsky, one of the great intellectuals of our time. He's 82 years old. He gets on a train from Boston and goes down to Washington, D.C. and does research in the National Archives so that if he talks about American policy toward Guatemala, he knows what he's talking about. So we have to just believe the intellectual life is very closely linked to the preservation of the individual. And we just have to have some faith in it and keep struggling for it. I don't know. I don't know what the future holds.
Because the way you write about it, I mean, the baby boomer generation, the radicals of the 60s, have become part of the elite. They've become part of the university system. There's a certain loss of that youthful desire to change things.
Right. I mean, the student movement of the 60s was not really a student power movement. It was the expression of a new consciousness, a new sense of freedom, a new sense of identification, especially with people in Mississippi, people in Vietnam. It was a lifting out of social places. But we can see now historically, we can see now in retrospect, that it was really the birth also of a meritocracy, of a two-tier society, so that people who went into the universities, went into law, went into the professions, medicine, and so forth, do very well in the United States. And yet we have a great majority of the country that has been doing increasingly worse, for many years.
Admitting that the future is impossible to predict, here we are sitting in London 6 months before a presidential election. I wondered how you read the direction of travel of the United States at the moment in political terms.
I think the election is, it's really unfortunate. I think that Obama really did have an opportunity. I think the United States, when I look at recent American history, I think there were three great missed opportunities. 1989, the fall of communism, the United States was really in a position to really lead the world. And by lead the world, I mean by example. I don't mean to dominate, but to really sort of set the tone for a new direction. I don't accept the idea that is very prevalent in the United States about what a dangerous world it is and so forth. I've traveled a lot. I know quite a bit about other countries. And most people are really just striving now for a decent life. 1989, instead of doing that, the United States pushed toward Russia, pushed to expand NATO. It continued to work as it had worked since 1945, or really earlier, through its military interests. And then a second missed opportunity was 2001, after the bombing of the World Trade Center. That was another moment when everyone turned to the United States, and the United States responded by invading Iraq. And then I think 2008 was another lost moment. I think everyone in the world really looked toward Barack Obama to really set a new tone and so forth. So I think that the way it's shaping up, with Obama claiming a somewhat vacuous center, although he has made a lot of gestures in the last, I guess, since Occupy Wall Street, really, he's absorbed a lot of the rhetoric and of Occupy Wall Street. Whether he'll be able to do anything or not is extremely dubious. And of course, Romney went all the way to the right to get the nomination in the Republican Party. So everything has really moved to the right so dramatically. It was actually better under Bush, in the sense that a great part of the country was opposed to Bush. It's not the situation now. Everything has sort of moved to the right, and a lot of people have been depoliticized. So I'm not very hopeful that the election, it looks as if Obama's going to win, though it's by no means certain. But I'm not very hopeful that the election will make a big difference. And it's hard to say what's going to happen with national politics in the United States. I'm not very optimistic about it. I don't see, you know, strong currents in the Democratic Party, so we'll see.
Eli Zaretsky. His new book, Why America Needs a Left, A Historical Argument, is out now in hardback. You can find full details about it on the Polity website at politybooks.com. I do hope you'll join me again soon for another Polity podcast. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.